Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with filmmaker Nathaniel Kahn. His documentary on the life of pianist Leon Fleischer was nominated for a 2006 Academy Award and can be seen on the Cinemax cable TV channel this Thursday. My Architect, his 2003 film about his father, Louis I. Kahn, was also shortlisted for an Oscar. Susan Lewis explores the excavation of the President's House at Independence Mall and considers the complicated nature of archaeological digs in urban settings. And Jason Pfeiffer explores the gritty world of sand sculpting. We'll hear from the professional who organizes the annual Cape May Amateur Sand Sculpting Contest. That's all ahead this morning, Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
From the age of 16, Leon Fleischer was a celebrated virtuoso pianist. For 20 years, he was hailed as one of the finest musicians of his generation. Then, in his mid-30s, an accident in the garden was the catalyst for a catastrophic loss of mobility in his right hand and, seemingly, the tragic end of a great career. He was diagnosed with an incurable neurological condition called focal dystonia, and his attempts to regain the use of the contorted fingers of his right hand included everything from hypnotism to EST to scotch, before he accepted his fate and turned to teaching, performing repertoire for the left hand, and conducting. However, from many years of gripping the baton so tightly, in 1982, Fleischer developed carpal tunnel syndrome. One of the procedures he underwent to alleviate this repetitive strain injury were Botox injections. This had the effect of lessening the contortion of his right hand caused by the dystonia, which eventually led to Leon Fleischer's return to playing piano with two hands. Two Hands is also the title of an Academy Award-nominated short film about Leon Fleischer by Nathaniel Kahn, which premieres on the cable channel Cinemax on Thursday. When Nathaniel Kahn came into our studios earlier this week, I asked him when he had first become aware of Leon Fleischer.
I actually, as a little boy, my mother played the piano, and I used to fall asleep under the piano and, you know, love the piano. Still love the piano. It sort of puts me to sleep, actually, except when a great player is playing. And we had all these records, and one of the ones that I really loved was of Leon Fleischer playing, I think it was a Grieg, the Grieg Concerto. And it just, you know, it so captured me. The energy of his playing and the passion of his playing, you can hear it, you know. And as a little boy, you kind of get that. Gee, this is different. This is not putting me to sleep. And so I was fascinated by this, you know, this player. And then later I actually picked up a copy of the National Geographic. And there were 12 poison stories in it, 12 stories of poison and what poison could do. Of course, some of them were about the Borgias, you know, the great poisoners in history, and various forensic evidence about how people were killed in the past. And then there was a story about Leon Fleischer, who was able to play with both hands again. It restored his right hand, was the use of Botox, which is one of the mm-hmm. most poisonous poisons known to man. So it was a poison tale, and I was so fascinated by, you know, such a strange kind of state of affairs where a poison allows somebody to, you know, to live, in effect, that I said, gee, this would be a great subject for a movie.
There's a scene in the film where you're talking to Leon Fleischer about how he dealt with the loss of the use of his right hand.
Yeah.
And he starts to talk about meditation and hypnosis and scotch. Yeah, and then you start to add to the list.
Sure.
And he leans forward and says something along the lines of, yeah, I'm not expletive, want to talk about that.
Right, that's right. I blocked all that expletive out. Right.
And it's there's a jump cut there or something that...
Yes.
It was a most bizarre piece of film in the context of the rest of the film. Why did it stay in?
It's actually my favorite moment, I think, in the film because it's so enormously real. Leon Fleischer is somebody who's been interviewed many times, and he's very practiced at it. And he's also told this story before. It's not the first time he's talked about
it. To me, among many others.
Okay, right. So the difficulty with something like that is making it spontaneous, making it real, making the emotion real. Because an audience knows in a second if something's canned, especially when you're that close. You know, it's very close on his face, and, you know, he's 30 feet across on a big screen. So I had to push him, and we came back several times to that. And it's really, in the end, it's a technique. You circle back to something that somebody doesn't want to talk about. And eventually they show how they really feel about it, not how they feel about it when you sort of, you know, catch them and they can do their canned answer.
I call it the dinner party story, yeah,
exactly.
Where they've told something so many times that they get practiced at it, and even the emotion is practiced at that point.
Exactly. And, you know, the question with filmmaking or with radio, with however you're getting a story out of somebody that's real, is being able to get it as if they've never told it before. So I pushed Leon several times, and the jump cuts really are about my pushing him time and time again to talk about this. And eventually you can see it in his face. This thing hurt like crazy. I mean, can you imagine being a pianist at the height of your career? You have everything, as Leon says, all the cookies. He had all the cookies, and suddenly it's taken away. I mean, it almost...
With no explanation, was the phenomenal thing. There was no physiological reason for this.
That's right, and nobody could figure it out. I mean, it feels like a stroke from the Greek gods. You know, this is an ancient story. And so wanting to get back to that emotion, and then what you try anything. Of course, you try everything. Western medicine doesn't have an answer. You try meditation, you try hypnosis, you try EST, at that point was a big thing. You try everything. And actually, the Scotch story is that it wasn't about drinking. What it was about is Leonard Bernstein, at a party, actually poured Scotch on his hand, hoping that perhaps that would cure it. So, but all of those moments coming out with Leon, suddenly I think you see in those jump cuts that this guy still feels so much about those lost 30 years.
But that said, later on in the film, he then goes on to say that he wouldn't have changed anything.
Yes, yes.
Was he being truthful?
Oh, I think so. It's a startling thing. I mean, I think one of the things that he has is he genuinely has peace in his life. And this is something in My Architect, there is no resolution to that story. My father never had peace. Leon Fleischer has peace. He has a wonderful wife who's also a fantastic pianist. He has a great family. And he has, I think, the sense in the end that music and that art transcends all of it. And that one life and the struggles of one life, really in the context of music, means very little.
Did he at any point talk about how all of this misery had... You've heard this idea that only great art can only come from great misery.
Yes.
Did you ever get a sense from him that he believed that if he hadn't gone through this suffering, that he wouldn't be the artist that he is?
Oh, it's a fantastic question. And I think when you hear his playing now, and he has an album, marvelous album, called Two Hands, which is the same name as the movie. We couldn't think of a better one. And I asked him, is it all right if we call the movie the same? And he said, of course, it's a great, great title. And if you listen to that recording, Two Hands, you hear in the music, you hear that struggle. And you hear the joy of being able to return to what you love. I think of it as somebody like a great traveler who's gone on an enormously difficult journey. And after all these years of being away and all these adventures and wonderful things that have happened and terrible things, they come back through the forest and there's that little light that is their home. And they follow that light and they walk through the front door and they just say, I'm home. I'm back. And I hear that in his playing now, which I don't think would ever have been there if he hadn't been out there in the wilderness for 30 years.
Thank you.
Leon Fleischer's 2004 CD Two Hands. We heard an excerpt from the final movement of Schubert's Sonata in B-flat major. Nathaniel Kahn's short film about Leon Fleischer is also called Two Hands, and it debuts on the Cinemax cable channel this Thursday evening at 7.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
This coming week, excavation at the site of the President's House at 6th and Market Streets in Philadelphia will wrap up, and the site will be covered over while a task force decides what to do next. More than 250,000 visitors have stood on the public viewing platform to watch this archaeological dig, and this week WRTI's Susan Lewis went under the wire to give us a down-in-the-dirt view of what's involved in this kind of urban excavation.
For those of us who, as kids, like to shovel in the sand or dig in the dirt, an archaeological site has a sort of primal appeal. There's an extra allure when it's happening right smack in the middle of a city, like Center City, Philadelphia, and when what's beneath the dirt is of national importance. National Park Service archaeologist Jed Levin, who has led this effort, takes us down into the pit.
The biggest trick, in a way, is getting under the fence. This is the way I do it. Keep your hands on the wires.
Okay.
So you don't slip, and then I'll hold the ladder for you.
Once down the ladder, we're standing about 11 feet below street level in the middle of a dirt floor, the site of the one-time residence of, among others, William Penn's grandson, General Benedict Arnold, and General Howe of the British occupation. All this before it became America's executive residence, home to George Washington and his household, and John Adams. The dirt space is divided by the remnants of two distinct foundation walls, one from the 18th century residence, and another from a 19th century structure that replaced it.
If you follow me and walk carefully, don't step on this one, that's 18th century, so we step over those.
How can you tell the difference?
Number of ways. Different construction techniques or materials that were used in different periods can be a clue to us. Artifacts that are associated with a particular wall segment, perhaps that fell into or thrown into the pit around a foundation, may help us understand when it was built. Maps can help us by pinpointing the location and matching them with what we find. And sometimes it's something as simple as this.
It seems almost incredible that America's first executive office and residence would have been matter-of-factly torn down. But Levin says that people in the 19th century weren't yet concerned with historic preservation, although somebody knew there was something special about this site.
One of the stores that were built in the 19th century, for many years it was a clothing store called Washington Hall Clothing. Now, I doubt most of the clerks, or certainly the customers coming in the store, knew why. But somebody did, because they named it that.
Of all the residents who occupied this space, the ones whose memory has compelled this excavation are not those in high office, but nine people named Oney Judge, Moll, Austin, Hercules, Richmond, Giles, Paris, Christopher Shields, and Joe Richardson. Although Pennsylvania had outlawed slavery in 1780, there were exceptions for those born before the law. Those born to a slave mother after the law were considered indentured servants until the age of 28. President George Washington claimed Virginia residency and is believed to have moved the nine slaves he held in Philadelphia back and forth to Virginia to avoid being subject to Pennsylvania law. The irony of this activity taking place on the site we celebrate Liberty came to a head as the Liberty Bell Center was getting ready to open.
A local historian named Edward Lawler Jr. wrote an article that was published in 2002. He pointed out that when people came to the Liberty Bell Center, which now stands behind us, to see the Liberty Bell, the preeminent symbol of American liberty, that those visitors would be walking over, as they do today, the area at the, towards the back of the President's House that George Washington ordered enclosed as a slave quarters.
The resultant controversy led to this excavation, done specifically to see what else could be learned about this house and the lives of all those who lived here, voluntarily or not. Archaeologists set to work, first with machinery, then by hand, all the while being careful not to disturb either the historical finds or the contemporary infrastructure, something Levin says his colleagues in the desert or countryside don't have to worry about.
They have to deal with things like poisonous snakes. Here in the city, we have other hazards, like utilities like this. Might be electrical, might be gas, might be sewer, and we cannot afford to disrupt the services to current inhabitants or risk harm to ourselves when we inadvertently, say, cut electric lines. So you have to proceed very carefully. Personally, I'd rather face the poisonous snakes.
There were some surprises. One was the curved foundation for a bow window, believed to be the room where the president received visitors, in a shape strikingly suggestive of another Oval Office. Another surprise was that the kitchen walls went deep enough to indicate a basement, as well as an underground passageway from the main house to the kitchen and slave quarters beyond. On the day we visit, there is still digging going on. Archaeologist Eileen Krall has been 20 feet down at the bottom of a well, where she shoveled dirt into a bucket to be hauled by pulley to the surface. Actually, she's been shoveling mud since the team hit water, something that's not so helpful on an excavation site.
It was a little disappointing because the other wells we didn't hit water at all. It's difficult. You can't see what you're digging. You can't see what you're excavating. You can't see the bottom of the well. We're not quite sure if we're there yet. We think we have another 2 feet to go.
Eileen Krall and her colleague, archaeologist Lovely Elise, haul the mud to a horizontal screen. While Krall hoses it off, Elise fingers the muck.
Looking for any material culture, from glass, bone, ceramic, anything that's not natural. We're looking for anything that's not a rock.
As we watch, bits of ceramics and broken glass become visible.
The bottom of a wine bottle?
Occasionally, amidst the rubble, there is an unlikely find.
In one of the wells, we found a complete earthenware terracotta vessel. It's like a large vase. They call it Philadelphia redware. And it's brown glaze, has some decoration at the top. It's about a foot in height. It was interesting that it was intact at the very, very bottom of the well. I don't know if it landed on, maybe there was water in there at one point before it dried up and it hit the water, or they were bringing the bucket up full of water and they wanted to put the water into that jug and it fell in. Who knows? But still, it was a pretty neat to have it completely intact.
The finds are washed and protected. Small pieces put into a Ziploc bag, which will be labeled and sent to the lab only a few blocks away at the Independence Living History Center. Willie Hoffman directs the lab, where archaeologists and volunteers pore over literally millions of small artifacts, from broken china to buttons, thimbles, and tobacco pipes.
For the most part, what we work with is household trash. It's things that basically sort of accumulate over time. Just from, you know, daily life, things that people would use. You would, you know, break a plate or break a bottle and sweep up the pieces and then throw them out.
They would end up in your backyard?
Basically in the backyard areas. This is a time period before the garbage man.
The pieces are put together and mended if possible, so that they can then be analyzed by historical archaeologists like Hoffman and Debbie Miller, the lab's assistant director.
We know exactly what is there on the tables. We look at these materials 40 hours a week, and this is a blue transfer print plate, and you can see that it's missing approximately 3 pieces, and there is enough of that there to certainly get what information we want to obtain from it, fully identify it, and we'll be able to properly analyze it.
The ceramic pieces spread before us this day are not from the President's house, but from the excavations at the site of the National Constitution Center.
In sort of juxtaposition to the work being done at the President's house is that while Washington, of course, had enslaved African Americans who were living there, we actually have a few households of free black folks who are living here. And it is sort of an interesting contrast. You know, just a few blocks away, there's really sort of a different story happening.
In some ways, this archaeological excavation is like a set of Chinese boxes, each with its own jigsaw puzzle. Pieces of ceramics fit together to make plates and dishes. The dishware itself is but a small clue to the mystery of any one family's life. The households taken together form a larger story about the people of historic Philadelphia, which story, in turn, is a piece in the puzzle of who we are today.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. There's still a chance to observe excavations at the President's House at 6th and Market Streets in Philadelphia. The dig continues until Tuesday. The archaeological lab at the Independence Living History Center at 115 South 3rd Street is open for viewing on weekdays. When you go to the shore, it's hard to avoid it. Sand is seemingly everywhere. Sometimes the gritty stuff can be an annoyance. It makes its way into our shoes, pockets, suitcases and cars, somehow managing to stick around for weeks after a trip to the shore. At the same time, most people can't help but also have some affection for sand. Really, let's face it, wouldn't long walks on the beach just be a short clamber over the rocks if sand wasn't a part of the equation? Children spend hours playing in it at the water's edge, burying themselves and their parents, and crafting castles of sand. But the digging, piling, and padding of the little grains isn't just for kids. Many so-called grown-ups can't stay away from it either. If you're in Cape May next weekend, you might bump into one man who's especially passionate about playing in the sand. Matt Long is a professional sand sculptor, and this Friday he's overseeing the 8th annual Cape May Sand Sculpting Contest. Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer recently spent a few hours with the New York-based sand sculptor to talk about his summertime obsession.
There's a little water in there.
On a clear, beautiful, but windy day in Cape May, New Jersey, Matt Long toils away with a shovel, bucket of water, and an array of small sand sculpting tools as he explains how to create the foundation of a potentially crumbly sculpture.
You want to make sure that it gets in there uniform. You don't want a dry spot to show up on you where it's loose. You'll start carving and it'll fall down. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to add sand to an area later.
It's obvious that Matt Long has given sand sculpting considerable thought and observation. He's been making sand creations for about 12 years.
But I can honestly say that I did not make anything worth looking at till about 2000. And since then, I've appeared on Regis and Kelly and the Today in New York show, and I've sculpted for the PGA Tour and lots of other places, Atlantis Casino down in the Caribbean. And I get hired pretty regular to do this, to have fun.
Matt Long and his family, who are from New York City, have been coming to Cape May in the summer for decades, nearly 30 years. He considers the Victorian beach town a second home. But although the shore has been a regular part of his life for many years, Long wasn't captivated by the art of sand sculpture until the mid-90s.
And on this next beach over, I was out for a stroll one day, and, I saw an amazing sight. There was a guy in a raft, and he's paddling away from a shark that was eating the back of the raft, and it was all done in sand, and I was just absolutely hooked. I went back to the blanket with my family, and I started making the most ridiculous, absurd-looking castles that I was so proud of. And they would move far away from me on the beach, And that's the truth. And then I got a little bit better over the first 4 or 5 years, but it was still pretty embarrassing. And I went to a professional sand sculpting contest, and I saw a professional do it. And once I saw the tricks that they used, it took right off. I found my creative niche in sand.
When it's not beach season, Long's full-time job is restoring wood in old buildings. His expertise with woodwork comes in handy with his sand work. Soon after taking up his sand hobby, he discovered there aren't very many specialized tools for sand sculpting out there. Many sculptors end up using kitchen utensils. So Long decided to design his own tools, carving the prototypes out of wood. After years of experimenting with and tweaking a set of 6 tools, he now sells sand paraphernalia to people on the side. They're called Can You Dig It sand tools. Long says seeing other people become excited about the art form is one of the most thrilling aspects of doing his sculptures every summer. He often holds free clinics for people on the beach and organizes an amateur sand sculpting contest every August in Cape May.
We probably get upwards of 1,000 people entering. They'll come create everything from cameras to sofas and living room settings. Castles are a big part of it. Fish, horses, lobsters, you name the sea animal or anything. And I guess we call it a contest more than a competition, but it's just a great day out. Everybody wins.
In watching masses of people of all skill levels trying their hand with sand, Long says a common piece of advice he has for aspiring sculptors is to learn patience.
When anyone asks me, how did you get started in this, the first answer is a failure to be able to sit still and do nothing at the beach. So there shows the lack of patience, but when you're actually doing it, it's very focused, and you learn to take your time. You can't rush this.
Of course, learning the craft of sculpting sand takes more than just patience. There are many little tricks to master. Simple things like selecting the right sand and knowing how much water to use. And then there's the job of simply envisioning what to sculpt. Long has created a great variety of forms in the past, many close to his heart.
The sculptures I'm most proud of, I do each year right at Ground Zero for the fire department who lost so many lives. There's a tunnel to Tower Run that remembers one specific fireman who ran through the tunnel on 9/11. You know, I knew him. And, you know, and all the firemen who died on that day. And it's a great day in New York City, and I've sculpted three or four times there now. I did fire trucks. I did about a 50-foot-long helmet 1 year, and did a very large American flag over a fire truck. Where do you come up with the ideas? They're tricky. I did Thomas the Tank Engine down here one time because there was a little boy carrying a Thomas the Tank Engine backpack, you know. So, okay, Thomas the Tank Engine today. You get your ideas from funny places.
Sand sculpture is something, maybe you could compare it to a performer who sings or plays music, in that it's kind of there, but eventually that sand sculpture is going to blow away. Do you have thoughts on that, kind of the ephemeral nature of it versus, you know, a painting or a stone sculpture?
Yeah. I've been asked this question a lot of times, you know, what about this zen-like quality to it, that it's there and it's gone? And in the very beginning, you know, I kind of wanted to hold on to them, and it's obviously impossible. You get used to it, and it's just part of it. You're not in an art form that's going to last. You create it. It's the most fun for spectators while it's going on. And you walk away. I've had kids jump on them when I walked away from it myself before I was done, and that's a little distressing, but they're all going to go, you know, and you just really do get used to it.
Matt Long adds that he wonders if his sculptures did last, would he make as many as he does? Maybe this fleeting nature of the form is what brings the young at heart, like Matt Long, back year after year. As the summer fades, we really can't hang on to the smell of the ocean or the sensation of digging our toes into the sand. But the seashore itself does remain, waiting for a new season of sunbathers, swimmers, and indeed, sand sculptors.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream.
Bum, 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 bum.
Make him the cutest that I've ever seen.
Bum, 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 bum.
Give him two lips like roses and clover.
Bum, 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 bum.
Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Sandman, I'm so alone.
Bum, 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 bum.
Don't have nobody to call my own.
Bum, 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 bum.
Please turn on your magic beam. Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream.
Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer with sand sculptor Matt Long. The 8th annual Cape May Amateur Sand Sculpting Contest takes place this Friday at the 2nd Street Jetty and Cove Beach in Cape May from 9 a.m. until 1 in the afternoon.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen. Give him the word that I'm not a rover. Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Magic beam, Mr. Sandman, bring us, please, 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 Mr. Sandman, bring us a dream.
And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Amy Gray and Jane Cowley. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore. And I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.